talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. You're listening to The Reckoning with Timothy Shea on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
If it's Friday, that must mean that we have another special counsel appointed for Donald Trump. Trump announces his run for the presidency on Tuesday, so of course on Friday, after everyone stops paying attention to what's going on in Washington, we get another special counsel. You know, the playbook has not changed in decades. They keep using the same one. And do you know why? Because it keeps working. Shame on us for letting it continue. Garland appointed Jack Smith, who currently prosecutes war crimes at The Hague, as the special counsel. Well, if he appointed someone who prosecutes war crimes, this must be serious. No, it's just another clown show. Corrupt DOJ, FBI, break into Mar-a-Lago with the permission of a judge, dog and pony show. Smith will take over the investigation related to Trump's handling of presidential records and documents with classified markings. And, you know, listen to this guy. I intend to conduct the assigned investigations and any prosecutions that may result from them independently and in the best traditions of the Department of Justice. Let me clue you in, Smith. Nobody respects the Department of Justice anymore. The best traditions? Those days are long gone. The days of people looking up to the FBI because Efrem Zimbalist Jr. was on TV on Sunday nights. Or whatever night, I think it was on Sunday nights, FBI. Great show back in the early 70s. Basically a propaganda puff piece showing how great the G-men were. Nope. No more. Nobody trusts you guys. You have become weaponized arms of the Biden administration, and appointing a special counsel isn't going to shield you from electoral liability on this. And the good news front, and I'll tell you right now, the same thing that I've told my audience for years, the same thing I told my children growing up. You will always know that I'm telling you what I believe to be the truth. I might be wrong sometimes, but if I make a mistake, I admit it. But you'll always know I'm telling you the truth because you won't always like to hear what I have to say. And as I did earlier this week, I'm going to give some credit to a Democrat. Adam Frisch conceded to Lauren Boebert in Colorado 3. And not only did he concede, he did it with the Facebook Live video so that no one could take his words out of context. No one could, quote unquote, misinterpret them. He said the likelihood of a recount changing more than a handful of votes is very small. Very, very small. It would be disingenuous and unethical for us or any other group to continue to raise false hope and encouraging fundraising for a recount. Of course, because the Democrats were out fundraising on a recount immediately. And to be fair, so was Lauren Boebert because she needed the money, right? Lauren's doing this. She's a brave little spitfire, I'll tell you. I love this girl's spunk. I love her passion. I love her patriotism. We are so proud at MAGA Institute to have had her in our inaugural class of America First certified candidates. So Adam Frisch went on, and he criticized the Democrat Party, saying that they are losing rural and working class Americans. They certainly are. And here's the thing. This isn't Republican versus Democrat. This is the swamp versus the people. Mitch McConnell is doing the same thing to MAGA, using the same playbook once again that he used in 2011 and 2012, colluding with Paul Ryan to stamp out the Tea Party. And that's capital TEA, taxed enough already. But the first popular uprising in this country this century was the Tea Party. People had had enough of 2 years of Obama. We were taxed enough already, and we were fighting back. We took to the streets nonviolently. Ours were actual peaceful protests, not mostly peaceful protests with city blocks burning in the background, like we had with BLM, Antifa, whatever they wanted to call that mess up in Seattle. And Mitch and the boys are doing the same thing again. Same exact playbook. Mitch McConnell would rather be the minority leader than to be leader of a party that had a significant populist presence, significant populist bent. That's not what the Republicans are about. We call them GOPE for a reason. They're the GOP establishment. It's two wings of the same dirty bird, Democrat or Republican. It doesn't matter. You just get slightly different flavors of taxation, of overregulation, of stifling bureaucracy that limits your freedom. Republican or Democrat, doesn't matter. What matters is electing people that are going to fight this, people like Lauren Boebert. That is the fight we have. And we fight so that we can preserve at least a modicum of freedom in this country. This is The Reckoning. You're listening to TNT Radio.
It's the stuff.
It's that division
people are talking about.
And that cluelessness that they want to push.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to The Reckoning. My guest this hour, I'm very excited to speak with her. Stella Morbido served for a decade as an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, where she focused on communist media, propaganda, and disinformation. She has a master's degree in Russian and Soviet history from the University of Southern California, and her essays have appeared in various publications, including Washington Examiner, American Greatness, Public Discourse, Town Hall, and the Human Life Review. She's been a senior contributor to The Federalist since 2014, where she's published numerous articles that focus on the social fallout of propaganda, mob psychology, and the cult mindset. I'd like to welcome to The Reckoning, Stella Morbido.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's great to be here with you. I'm really looking forward to talking about my book, The Weaponization of Loneliness.
Oh, absolutely. And we're gonna get to that. Her new book is The Weaponization of Loneliness, How Tyrants Stoke Our Fear of Isolation to Silence, Divide, and Conquer. It is available on Amazon now. But before we get to your book, I want to lead up to that. Okay. What did you do your undergraduate work in, and what led you to want to get a master's degree in Russian and Soviet history?
Oh, wow. Well, my undergraduate degree, my bachelor's, it was a double major in international relations and journalism, which, of course, today we know journalism isn't what it was cracked up to be in those days. But
you got arrested for committing journalism these days.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. I have always been fascinated by psychological manipulations that you see in, you know, many different, a lot of different places in life. I mean, you know, on the playground, playground bullies, or whether it's like the mean girl diva kind of attitude, or the toxic boss, or the, the cult leader like Jim Jones. And then, of course, the world class dictator. And that's my focus. And that was my focus, of course, studying for my master's degree in Russian and Soviet history. And it's all based on that fascination with psychological manipulation, particularly what I consider the common denominator of all destructive agendas, or what gives destructive agendas their oxygen. And what allows them to see the light of day, my thesis, is this impulse we have to self-censor, and this impulse we have to shut up about what we believe, so that when the agenda, you know, has moved along to a point that becomes policy, everybody's shut up for so long that we've cultivated the ground for it. And I think that that's what happens in history, and that is what is happening today. I boil it down to what I call the weaponization of loneliness. It's through this machinery that we all know instinctively about. I mean, we shut up about what we believe a lot of times because we're afraid of being ostracized. We're afraid of being socially rejected. And that fear is based on our need as, you know, social animals, social creatures, human beings to connect with others. So that fear is very easily exploited by tyrants, has always been exploited. And we see it happening mostly through demonization campaigns. The smear, mostly the smear, is why people
and the wrap up smear.
The wrap up.
You got the the smear, and then what Nancy Pelosi called the wrap up smear. You smear somebody, and then once people are thinking negatively about them, then you have the wrap up smear.
Okay, well, I missed that from Nancy Pelosi. You know, that might have been what we call a limited hangout or projection, you know, psychological projection.
Oh, 100%. And I talk often on the show, the roots of propaganda. Edward Bernays, Sigmund Freud's nephew, literally wrote the book Propaganda that was used by Goebbels for the Nazis in World War II. But it was also the playbook for the Soviet Union. And quite frankly, it's also been the playbook here. I mean, we had the Smith-Mundt Act that prohibited propagandizing American people on American soil until the 2012 NDAA, which was rammed through in the middle of the night, the Smith-Mundt Repeal Act, and then in 2016 in the NDAA, they stood up the Global Engagement Center at the Department of State, which sounds all nice and good that you want to engage with other communities to tamp down Islamic terrorist recruitment. But that's not what it's being used for. And I want to dig in a little bit to your experience with the CIA, because I've talked openly about how we do propagandize. We had Radio Free Europe during the Cold War. We've got Voice of America. Mm-hmm. We propaganda, you know, propaganda isn't in and of itself something evil, right? It can be used for good. We propagandize on the benefits of capitalism, which has been the greatest wealth creation engine in the history of mankind. It is something that has lifted people out of poverty every time it's been tried. You know, the old, I think it was Winston Churchill that said, capitalism is the second worst economic system ever tried, and the worst is every other economic system that's ever been tried. So we propagandize our positive values, freedom, liberty, justice. It can be a good thing. You kind of saw it from behind the curtain as an analyst.
Well, okay. So I could talk a little bit about that experience per se, but I want to address first what you were talking about, propaganda being a good thing. I think that there is, we need to always make a distinction between persuasion through open engagement and coercion through the suppression of any other point of view. And so if you propaganda, you know, you can call it propagandizing an idea, trying to persuade through, you know, civil discourse, an idea, and you have exchanges, open exchanges. That's what makes up a civil society. And then if you're trying to coerce the propaganda that we usually think of, and that what I'm referring to in my book is the coercion of one narrative by suppressing, making a point of suppressing every other narrative. And the most effective way of doing that is by inducing people to self-censor. We do most of the work for these tyrants through, you know, by self-censoring. And when we do that, we shut up about
it. Sure, you wouldn't want to be impolite, would you?
Oh, there you go. And you
that's
know,
what,
there,
you
of
know,
course
you're,
we want to be polite. I mean, that's actually, a value of civil society. A lot of people.
Oh, sure. But they use that against us to try to shut us up.
Well, and exactly. And Saul Alinsky came right out and said that use their goodwill against them to, you know, push forward this, the radicalism of really just the one narrative, the one party state or, you know, what have you. Totalitarianism really is what it is. So, my experience, I was a junior analyst, kind of a fly on the wall in a lot of ways also, but I was focused on, you know, I worked for the office that dealt with, you were talking about Radio Free Europe, broadcasting through, not Radio Free Europe, of course, but the propaganda coming out of the Soviet Union through Pravda and all the broadcasts and the big speeches and the Kremlinology and who's down in the Politburo, up in the, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, who's standing next to whom up top Lenin's tomb.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you just kind of analyze that sort of stuff. But I'm just going to tell you, kind of related to that, there was a lot of leftism when I was there. And now, of course, as we can see, it's like total now. But even while I was there, there was a big contingent, like faculty lounge, basically, analysts. And
that's a great insight. I want to
branch chiefs. Yeah.
So it's a great insight. I want to dig into that after the break.
TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Kyrie Irving was suspended by the Brooklyn Nets of the NBA after he did not apologize. He shared a clip on his social media from a film called Hebrews to Negroes, Wake Up Black America. Contains numerous anti-Semitic tropes. Irving apologized, quote unquote, after he was suspended without pay for 5 games. But this is the 5th game. And by the way, the 5th game is tonight. He's not playing. And guess what? The Nets have won 3 out of 4 without Kyrie Irving. But it's heating up again for various reasons. And I've never seen high-profile people coalesce around a man who committed a despicable anti-Semitic act. But that's what's happening. Los Angeles Lakers superstar, or whatever you want to call him, LeBron James, says that he believes Kyrie Irving's suspension should end immediately and he should be allowed to play. He tweeted, "I told you guys I don't believe in sharing hurtful information and I'll continue to be that way, but Kyrie apologized and he should be able to play. That's what I think. It's that simple. Help him learn, but he should be playing. What he's asked to do to get back on the floor, I think, is excessive, in my humble opinion. He's not the person that's being portrayed of him. Anyways, back to my rehab session." Oh, okay, great.
Steve Malzberg on TNT Radio.
Did you know that hepatitis C causes tens of thousands of U.S. deaths every year? Hepatitis C is the leading cause of cirrhosis and liver cancer, and the leading cause of death from liver disease. Those who have hepatitis C often don't even know it. But there is good news. Not only good, but easy. A simple blood test will tell you whether or not you have hepatitis C. If you do have it, it's curable. More than 9 out of 10 people who receive highly effective treatment are cured and less likely to develop liver cancer or liver complications. In fact, one little blood test and you can do your part to help eliminate hepatitis C for good. Get tested, get treated, get cured. Visit hep.org for more information.
As Joe Biden negotiates his way out of the room, we don't negotiate with the truth. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to The Reckoning. My guest this hour, Stella Mirabito, is the author of Weaponization of Loneliness, How Tyrants Stoke Our Fear of Isolation to Silence, Divide, and Conquer. Stella, before we broke, you were saying how you saw in CIA a kind of left-wing faculty lounge type mentality. Could you tease that out a little bit?
I can try. It just kind of feeds into the issue of institutional subversion, you know, how our institutions, government, not just government institutions like intelligence and foreign policy, but also, the courts, legislatures, education, medicine, you know, all the institutions are being corrupted. But I could see that even while I was there, and I was there in the 1980s, this was the Reagan administration all throughout. And, it was just, you could pick up some of it just through fellow analysts who, for example, Reagan gave the Evil Empire speech. And, you know, there are analysts who are kind of like, ooh, you know, you know, ooh, he shouldn't say that. And there would be, well, you know, probably the story, the background to that, you know, a lot of state folks did not even, you know, didn't want him to put that in his speech and right. They crossed it out. He put it right back in, you know, but there, you know, you could see the dynamics, the kind of the, and unfortunately I was kind of quiet about it, except I would say, well, maybe if they are evil, maybe you should say it, but you could see fellow analysts.
Yeah, killing tens of millions of your own citizens isn't exactly not evil.
Well, exactly right. So there was this kind of social pressure already to take that particular tack on the evil empire. And then, of course, I had experiences with, like, I had a division chief who came right out and said that, you know, I mean, she made her leftist you know, views known pretty widely and just kind of in your face about it. And I remember even saying, you know, you have to change the institution from within. I mean, I heard, like, as a fly on the wall, her saying that. And that, of course, echoes what Rudi Deutschke, the German activist radical in the 60s, was talking about when he was...
Well, and you mentioned him already. Saul Alinsky said a genuine radical cuts his hair, puts on a suit, and joins the establishment. That's exactly what they did. They did it in education. They did it in the arts. They did it in government.
Mm-hmm. And that was the idea. I mean, that was the idea with the Frankfurt School, which about 100 years ago, who took a page from the Italian communist, Gramsci.
Yeah.
You know, he made the point that, you know, this business with, you know, workers of the world and the economics, this is not going to play out that well in the West. You know, it's like it's not working. And so he believed that there should be a focus on the culture. And then, of course, the Frankfurt School picked up on that and they started an academia. And of course, it trickles down. You know, if you need to get credentialed, you have to go through that institution of academia and, you know, education.
And it's hard to believe, but it was 72 years ago that William F. Buckley published God and Man at Yale, which was an expose of the communist tendencies in the English and history departments at Yale University. That was 1950, which it's amazing to think. I'm 60, so it's amazing to think that 1950 was 72 years ago, but there it is.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, I'm actually kind of surprised, and I think the other side is very frustrated, but I'm kind of surprised that we haven't totally fallen apart by now, based on the way things were going, and they must be extremely frustrated that we're really hard nut to crack. So that should give us some hope, but you're right, you know, it's been 72 years since he wrote that, and it's been about 100 years almost since, you know, they came out in the 1930s from Frankfurt to, you know, settled into Columbia University to push this whole thing. And the idea then was that what they really needed to do was what they called the long march through the institutions. And Marcuse, mm-hmm. Herbert Marcuse was a big part of that. And so here we are. And so, you know, the antidote to that, in my opinion, is we have to build these parallel institutions and parallel polices. I mean, we're at the point now where it's really an asymmetric cultural war. I mean, we're not going to be able to fight it through these institutions like education, forget it. Mainstream media, forget it. It has to be really on that one-on-one level that Václav Havel wrote about in his famous essay, The Power of the Powerless. All of the real strength mm-hmm. of society comes from the private sphere, what he called the hidden sphere of life, family, faith, communities, friendship, real community, true community. None of these, you know, little communities they talk about, you know, LGBT community, transgender community. No, real community where people feel they can engage openly. And that's how it has to be done. And it has to be done by first recognizing, developing the awareness of where we are, because these patterns have played out through history. I have one chapter in there where I go through it from the French Revolution, the Bolsheviks, the Hitler's Third Reich, Mao's cultural revolution and all the struggle sessions, where the weaponization of loneliness was, at full throttle. I mean, they,
Well, even in the recent scamdemic, we've got the smoking gun email out of England saying, hey, guys, we might want to tone down on the fear porn because we overdid it. People are so afraid they're not doing anything. They're not, not only are they not doing what we don't want them to do, they're not doing what we do want them to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, we already had a lot of headlines about a loneliness epidemic in the U.S. And then COVID just really fast tracked that by enforcing our isolation. Now, are you saying that you see a whole lot of resistance to that since it seems like things have eased up? Is that what you were saying there?
We uncovered an email that was from one British researcher, psychologist, to peers saying we need to ease up on the fear porn because it's been too effective. We overshot the mark. People are so afraid. Not only are they not doing what we don't want them to do, they're not doing what we do want them to do. And it's basically the smoking gun showing that this whole thing was a psyop and it was done for control. And I keep telling people the most powerful word in the English language is no. When people tell you to do something stupid, just say no. When people tell you to do something anti-science and anti-common sense, just say no. You know, the British military, the British Army was widely seen. The British Navy was certainly the unquestioned power of the seas. The British Army was one of the strongest, if not the strongest, army in Europe in the late 18th century. And yet a ragtag bunch of farmers and merchants and smithies and dock workers were able to defeat them by fighting an asymmetric war. And I'm using a military analogy, but that's not, I'm not calling for a military solution to our problems here, people. For all our friends in the three-letter agencies that are listening, I'm just analogizing. But that's exactly what we need to do. We need to stand up and say no in our individual spheres of influence. We need to fight an asymmetric war because we're not going to be able to develop a parallel CIA, a parallel NSA, a parallel FBI, right? And unless we can take our own long march through the institutions, which is going to be a protracted fight if we ever even have a chance of winning that, we have to do it in other ways, in ways that we can. I mean, that's, I think that totalitarianization of social media is going to be a big part of that. What's happening at Twitter is very interesting to see. The Babylon Bee is back today. President Trump isn't yet, but at least the Bee is back. Other accounts are slowly starting to come back. Elon still hoping for at TimboTim62 and at MAGA Institute to come back, please. But they're deathly afraid of us. Mitch McConnell, I said in the open, Mitch McConnell's opening the same playbook he used against the Tea Party, against the MAGA movement now, and he'd rather Democrats be in power than to have populists be in power. So there's no question that there's a struggle going on.
Yeah, no, it's very swampy. And this asymmetric issue is, I think, really important. We have to kind of... You know, I bring up the idea of, you know, starting discussion groups. Like I piloted a book club that dealt with a lot of these dynamics. I'll tell you, it was like pressure valves exploding all over the room when people talk about their personal experiences dealing with political correctness and the mob and all of that. And it was just really cathartic. And as more people become aware of these techniques and these methods, there's nothing new in these totalitarian methods. As I was saying earlier. And so it's just, I'll give you an example. I think that we need to try to lead the way as individuals, the strong individuals who have that private sphere to fall back on. Unfortunately, one reason it's such a tall order and a lot of hard work going forward is that there is so much brokenness. And so youth who, never had the benefit of a strong family to fall back on, let their hair down and express what they believe, or, all they have are the propagandized classrooms, they're very vulnerable to that mob mindset. And many of them, you know, if you look at Antifa or BLM mobs, you can bet that a lot of them are isolated and atomized already. That's, you know, that's how gangs and cults and, you know, mobs recruit from people who don't have a strong private sphere to fall back on. And that's why the private sphere has always been a target. But one example I'll give you is personal. Yesterday, so I was in a building. I'm not going to say exactly where or whatever, but I was in a building that required masks to enter. And it was stupid. You know, it was none of the other places around there, but they required masks. And everybody was in there with a mask. I refused to enter the building with a mask. But there are two elevators and one of them was broken and a big crowd was around the other elevator. And the security guy in the front, or the guy who says, "Hey, ma'am, here, ma'am." And he hands me a basket that has masks in it. And I said, "That's bullshit. No, where's the elevator? Can you tell me?" And he said, "Oh, I know it's bullshit." He said that. "I know it's bullshit, but you know, I could have you thrown out." I said, "Where's the elevator, please?" "Well, I can't make an elevator." Well, anyway, stairway. I was looking for the stairway. Excuse me. I was avoiding. But people around me heard that. They heard me say that's bullshit. And they heard him, more importantly,
right,
respond, "I know it's bullshit." So I said, "What are we just following orders here?" I could have elaborated on that.
Sure.
I try not to be too hostile, but I, you know, I found my way to the stairway. I wasn't looking for the elevator, looking for the stairway. Because I wasn't going to go in the elevator with a mob of masked people. Anyway, that was just an example of just a little tiny crack, a little thing that you could do. Like you just said, the most powerful word in the English language is no. And I just said no. And nothing
and good
really
on
happened
you.
To me.
Yeah, and that was my stock answer. I would have people come over to me and, "Here, sir, do you need a mask?" And I'd look at him and say, "No, thanks. I'm good." And just keep walking.
Mm-hmm.
Just keep walking.
That's right. And then, and the effect is mostly, as Václav Havel says in The Power of the Powerless, people might not say anything, but your behavior, use this in the parable of the greengrocer. I don't know if you're familiar with that parable, but he said the action, even if nobody says anything, it has an effect. It illuminates the truth, even for just a moment. And you pull back that curtain. And if more and more people did that, but it has to be people who, you know, it can't be coming from people who are already isolated and atomized and really scared.
Right.
It has to, people, there need to be leaders. There need to be people who are willing to take those risks. And it may be more able to take those risks. So anyway,
it harkens back. We need people to be more like the founders, right? I've got a friend who's toying with the idea of writing a book called FU Nation. And his premise is that we are a nation founded on FU. I mean, there's that great engraving of the Battle of Lexington Green, right? You've got the Redcoats on one side, you've got the Minutemen on the other side. They're all lined up pointing at each other. And some wag made a meme out of it. And it has a word bubble, a speech bubble. And the British Army leader is general, whatever rank he was, is saying, "Turn in your weapons." And someone from the Minutemen side just says, "F you."
And, oh, wow.
But that's our nation. That's how we got started. Yeah. Like, oh, you want to tax us? We'll dump your tea in the harbor. We have, you know, that's the whole myth of the Wild West. It's people saying, no, we're not going to conform to your stupid rules. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's why criminals have always been mythologized, whether it's Billy the Kid, Butch and Sundance, John Dillinger. You know, there's always been kind of a romanticized fascination with the bad boys that are going against the grain. I'm 6'5". I've got a shock of silver hair and I am avowedly not shy. And I've used that to my benefit because, you know, when I first started doing radio, my dad listened to one of my, I think it was the second show I ever did. And he said, "I love what you had to say. and your presentation was very entertaining, but do you really think you're going to change a lot of minds that way? And I said, Dad, I'm not trying to change anybody's mind. I'm trying to empower people, to give them talking points, to give them facts that they can use in arguments that they're making in their own circles. But to get them over their fear of standing up and speaking out, that's what I want. I said, I want everybody to just stand up and say no. And if I can do that, that's my mission. I want to pick up more. I want to dig into your book, The Weaponization of Loneliness, How Tyrants Stoke Our Fear of Isolation to Silence, Divide, and Conquer, with the author Stella Mirabito, after the break.
TNT Radio's David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan.
Former Detective Chief Inspector Peter Fox had a 36-year long history with the New South Wales Police Force, during which time he investigated countless episodes or allegations of child sexual abuse in the Hunter region of New South Wales, and this involved certain members of the Catholic Church.
The initial matter involved a now convicted priest by the name of Vince Ryan. He was a prolific predator. There's been a lot of documentation on his offences, but I think I became aware that much of this abuse, much of the rape of children had literally been going on in the Catholic Church, which was immediately behind my detective's office in Cecil. And of course that piqued a lot of interest in the community, and especially when he was charged. And there were attempts by various members of the clergy to conceal or avoid Vince Ryan being arrested. He was moved at the last minute from Cessnock to Taree. But nevertheless, he was arrested and has since served quite an extensive time in jail.
McBride and Brennan, with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Neil Armstrong waited 6 hours and 39 minutes to step onto the surface of the moon. Jackie Robinson waited 20 months to play his first game with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And even DiCaprio had to wait 22 years to win an Oscar. You can wait until your destination. Don't text and drive.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation donated more than $310 million to mainstream media.
We don't tell the story that Bill Gates wants you to know.
We tell the real story. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to The Reckoning. My guest this hour, Stella Mirabito. You can find her at Stella Mirabito, StellaMorabito.net, StellaMorabito.net, and on Twitter, at Stella_Morabito. And her book, The Weaponization of Loneliness, How Tyrants Stoke Our Fear of Isolation to Silence, Divide, and Conquer, is available on Amazon. Stella, before the break, you started talking about the book and how loneliness is weaponized. I guess I've never understood, for example, why solitary confinement is supposedly a very inhumane punishment, because speaking personally, if I were in prison, I would want to be in solitary confinement. And, you know, and if I were to have access to books, I wouldn't be in solitary confinement. It wouldn't matter if I'd be in a little cell by myself if I had a book. But I understand that most people aren't like that. I grew up in what we now call exurbs, and I was one of only three children in our neighborhood to go to my school. So we had, you know, long bus ride with almost no one on the bus. I grew up in the fields and woods of upstate New York, just spent a lot of time by myself out, you know, catching tadpoles and doing different things like that. So being alone has never discomforted me. And although you go through the usual socialization things in school of wanting to fit in and wanting to be one of the in crowd, and everybody wants to be part of the mix, and I get that aspect of it, I've never really understood. It always been kind of discomforted by people that weren't comfortable by being alone. But I also understand that that's the vast majority of people, and that that is a wedge, that is a pressure point that people with malign intent can use to exert their will over people. So I'm fascinated by this book. And why don't you tell us a little bit more about it?
Okay, well, yeah, people have different thresholds for solitude. And of course, loneliness, by loneliness, I don't mean solitude in the sense of exploration or you know, just meditation or, you know, anything like that. It's more of what I might call involuntary solitude. And when a human being is in a severe state of isolation for a long period, you know, there've been experiments and all kinds of crazy things can happen. We go haywire when we are completely cut off. And this is why solitary confinement for a long period, especially, is so damaging. I mean, people tend to hallucinate, and it's
almost
it's
like sensory deprivation.
Yes.
Like those sensory deprivation tanks experiments.
Yes, that's very much connected with severe isolation. Is you go into this state of just unmoored, you know, unanchored sense that there's nothing really to grasp onto. It's a very destabilizing feeling that can lead to psychosis. And also severe loneliness can lead not just to mental issues, but it can lead to physical. The stress can lead to physical ailments. You know, it's associated with stroke and early onset dementia and heart conditions and all that, you know, the stress.
Psychosomatic illness is a real illness. It's just that the origin is psychological rather than organic. Mm-hmm. But it's a very real illness, a psychosomatic illness.
Yeah, I think there's so much we don't know. There is still so much we don't know, not only about, you know, ourselves psychologically, but even physically. But this has fascinated me for a long time. I mean, you know, if you look at the effects of, you know, just bullying or gaslighting or, you know, cult isolation of people, people very easily take on that sense of like Stockholm syndrome, you know, the captain, bonds with the captor. And that's kind of like where we are now with so many broken families, the private sphere of life being so broken up, you know, with family, faith communities, community itself. You have broken families on a large scale. You're going to have broken communities on a large scale. It's so devastating in terms of civil society. So what happens when there's that much isolation in a society is people become more and more dependent on Big Brother. They become more and more dependent on the state. And to me, there's an analogy there with Stockholm syndrome. It's like the captive bonding with the captor for whatever sense of connection they can get. And it's really a pseudo connection. But people will take it, especially if they've been atomized, isolated, you know, through the breakdown of what should be primal bonds with family and, you know, friends or whatever. So
sure. And even law enforcement uses it when they play good cop, bad cop.
Absolutely. Oh, there's so many. You're right. There's so many different analogies we could use for that. And yet, even though we see it around us, we know about Stockholm syndrome, we know about good cop, bad cop, we know about gaslighting, and we all understand instinctively that, oh, I don't want to say anything because I'm afraid somebody's going to get offended. We understand it instinctively, but we absolutely need, I wrote the book because we absolutely need to understand how these patterns work on us, and we need to understand them consciously. We need to build a real awareness of how easily that primal fear is exploited and has been exploited throughout history, especially modern history. And it has an even greater, expectation that it'll be exploited on a grand scale globally now that we're all supposedly connected through our devices and, you know, the building of the surveillance state. And of course, the top-down censorship that they're pushing so hard in the Congress with the so-called, you know, what was it, the Misinformation Governance Board or whatever. And that'll come back. It'll come back.
Oh, it already has.
There's already
They just changed the name.
Right, between. Yeah. And well, and there, when we, and there was that Intercept article a couple weeks ago about the collusion between the government and corporations, especially big tech, to censor. I mean, to shut us up. And this is really dangerous stuff. So we absolutely have to understand that free speech is a use it or lose it thing. You got to learn to say no, especially if you are in a position to say no, that you don't carry the risks that so many other people carry. And, you know, you mentioned something else that was really interesting about, you know, what was going on with the American Revolution and the ragtag groups and everything. And we have this sense that, forget it, you know, we are who we are. We have individual rights. But the sense of isolation now, it comes in a lot of different forms. It comes through technologies, people just living virtual lives and forgetting, especially youth, not even knowing how to connect in real life and real time with people anymore. They're so immersed in their virtual, you know, realities. But it also comes through ignorance. Ignorance is extremely isolating. People don't understand that when the educrats, when the schools deprived generations really of students of valuable content knowledge about not just the Constitution, but about history, about, you know, the, you know, surveys of knowledge, of literature, of classics, of humanity, that ignorance leaves a huge vacuum. So, and it's
it really does. And I had the great benefit of a very strong liberal arts education. It's one of the most misunderstood people. That doesn't mean that I learned genderqueer theory, people. The liberal arts are history, literature, languages, the sciences, etc. And the ethos at my college was that we were learning how to learn, that learning was a lifelong process. And what we were doing wasn't acquiring, what we were doing was, in addition to acquiring factual knowledge, a body of knowledge, broadly and specifically, we had a thing called the baccalaureate essay. And in order to gain admission to senior year, which was called the baccalaureate year, you had to pass your baccalaureate essay written in your junior year. And what the baccalaureate essay was a bi-disciplinary essay that was written about two topics, or written about the same topic from two different points of view. So I did mine on the physical and psychological effects of chemotherapy on adolescent leukemia patients. My brother had leukemia, and I had a first-person account case study. And so I wrote it from the perspectives of biology and of psychology. And so you have a generalist read it, which has no experience in psychology or biology, and then I had a specialist read it. And you have to pass both your specialist and your generalist, because it has to be detailed and in-depth enough to please the specialist, but it has to be broadly accessible enough for the generalist to understand what you're saying. It was a profoundly valuable experience. Unfortunately, the school did away with that. Sure. But I got that benefit. I've always looked at learning as a lifelong experience. That's gone. In fact, in high school, I took what would be a college-level course today, if not a graduate-level course. It's not because my high school was so great, and it was, but it was. It's more a reflection on how bad the level of study and thought is in colleges and graduate schools today. It was a class on subliminal advertising, subliminal messaging. And we studied advertisements. For example, there was one, it was an ice hockey goalie, and there's a hockey equipment manufacturer called Cooper. And hockey goalies have a big mitt on one hand, It's the glove, and on the hand with which they hold the stick, they've got a big rectangular blocker. So you've got your blocker hand and your glove hand. And on the blocker, it will say Cooper. Well, in this Benson and Hedges ad, it didn't say Cooper. If you looked at it and you didn't need a magnifying glass, you could just read it. If you actually consciously looked at it and read it, it said cancer.
Oh, wow.
It was that obvious once you saw it. And that was the point of the class, is that once you see these things, you can't unsee them. So I think it's fantastic that we've got this book now, The Weaponization of Loneliness, How Tyrants Stoke Our Fear of Isolation to Silence, Divide, and Conquer. The author is Stella Morbido. Go get it on Amazon. Read it. Give it as a gift this Christmas. Pass it out to your friends. This is knowledge that we all need, because once you see this stuff, folks, you cannot unsee it. And I'll tell you right now, once you see it, you're going to see it everywhere.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on. I definitely would like to have you back, because I think this conversation could continue. But oh, yeah. I wish you great success with the book. It'll be interesting to watch what happens. I think this battle within the Republican Party, this battle for the heart and soul of the Republican Party between the America First contingent, the MAGA contingent, and GOPE, the Kevin McCarthy, Mitch McConnell wing, is going to be very interesting to see play out. And it's going to be interesting to see the pushback against the Biden administration with its pushing of the narrative. Now that they have voted to not, 13 Democrats broke ranks to not extend the national emergency, which was really over more than a year and a half ago. It's going to be interesting to see how they try to maintain control and try propagandizing and pushing these mRNA jabs. The data coming out is horrific, and it's just, it started as a trickle, and now it's coming out more steadily, and pretty soon it's going to be a tsunami, and people are not going to be able to maintain the lie that they've been pushing for the last 3 years. So Stella Morbido, yeah, Thank you so much for coming on The Reckoning.
Thank you so much for having me, Tim. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Likewise. Have a great Thanksgiving, and a happy holidays. Folks, I can't emphasize enough how important this issue is. You've heard me already, just in the last few weeks, talking about these issues, trying to open your eyes to them. For those of you who already knew about them, trying to give you a little bit more information. It's only by standing up. It's only by resisting. It's only by speaking out. It's only by saying no that we prevent what's happened the last 2 years from ever happening again. We just had elections, and one school board down in South Carolina, the very first vote they took was 6-3, no more CRT. And then it was 9-0. We're going to get rid of the sexually explicit pornographic books pushing homosexuality and other sexual behaviors in the schools. Local action works. School board after school board, parents are getting involved. And what is the federal government's response? They call us terrorists. They call us the greatest domestic terror threat in the country. Our parents telling school boards and telling schools that what they're pushing on our children is inappropriate. That's the America we live in now, folks. Our government is calling parents who do not want their children propagandized terrorists. The DOJ has you targeted. FBI has you targeted if you speak out at a school board meeting. Well, guess what? They know where I live. They're welcome to come for a chat anytime. We'll do a nice little Facebook Live if they show up in their cute little windbreakers. Stand up, speak out, and just say no.